Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Wine Insider Podcast. My name is Pietro, and I'm a former chef and restaurant consultant, but I've spent the last 14 years planting vineyards, making wine, and being a winery owner. I've also been involved in wine retail, wholesale, I've judged, I've even helped with competitions, branding, labels, compliance, all of that. So I've worked in most parts of the wine industry. These are a collection of Zoom tastings, there are a couple classes in here, and various wine discussions that take deep dives into specific grapes, a lot of wine history, some technical winemaking, and other aspects that I find really interesting in the business. If you're thinking about planting a vineyard or starting a wine brand, I am available for affordable consulting, and you can also check out my own wine brand at primamateriawinery.com. But I hope you get something out of these and enjoy all of the episodes. Thanks so much.
Pietro Butita.
Well, I keep throwing an extra
I in
there.
It's a lot of T's and I's. It's okay.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you. I was looking forward to this because it's a part of the winemaking country of California that people don't really understand or know about. It's called Lake County, and that's where you're making wines. And I want to peel that back a little bit. I want to talk to you about some of the things you were doing before you got into the wine business. Mm-hmm. But what does prima materia mean in the first place?
It's first matter. We have an alchemy theme with prima materia. It was just a nice way to combine grapes and wine growing and, you know, the transformation into wine and the beauty that comes with age. So in the alchemists are trying to figure out what the prima materia is and how to turn it into gold.
Oh,
so yeah.
Now I get it.
It's a nice overarching kind of concept. And it works with food, too. You know, you're transforming these humble materials into something higher.
Because the packaging is gorgeous on this. And look, it's wine, right? We're talking about a wine business. Business is business. packaging is important. And I often look at bottles and go, you know, it doesn't cost that much to create a decent-looking label. And it's, as it doesn't cost a crappy-looking label.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean... I wanted something simple, but, you know, these are detail-oriented wines for me with some complexity. So I wanted the labels to, you know, to mirror that. And there were all these really cool etchings in these old alchemy books from the 1600s and 1700s. And they're just filled with all these nuances and, you know, mercury and matter changing and silver and all these things. Wow. And it just really kind of mirrored the whole winemaking process.
Because, you know, our logo, which is actually not here.
Yeah.
Oh, there is a 15th century woodcut.
Oh,
that my dad stumbled across as a book years ago, and he's never allowed me to change it. Not that I would ever try. I've had to sort of redecorate it a little bit, but it's fun to go back and tie things together.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to the history of wine and winemaking, and in your case, alchemy.
I like history.
But you weren't always in the wine business. First of all, for the consumers, Lake County is where exactly?
Yeah, so Lake County is the next county north from Napa.
Due north.
But California sort of goes on a diagonal.
Yeah, right.
But Lake County shares a border with Napa Valley, Sonoma County, and Mendocino. So it's sort of the fourth corner of the north coast.
So the west of it, the mountains that separate the Napa Valley.
Yeah, so the Mayacamas Mountains that run through Napa Valley, that you know, all the Cabernet people talking about, also runs through Lake County. And that's the border with
kind
Sonoma,
of the Pyrenees
Mendocino.
And the Chile and Argentina, right? It separates
yeah,
the two.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's this beautiful spine.
So we were up there. I didn't start the fires. But when we were driving in, literally from Concord, we think we saw the lightning strike that started the first fire on the Mayacamas Mountains, and we were end up at San Helena for a couple of nights, and we were watching the glow. Did that fire creep into Lake County?
So which year?
Not 1820.
We were pretty fortunate in 20, actually. Sonoma County and Napa got it really bad.
Yeah.
And I was actually driving to an early morning pick in Napa Valley when the glass fire started at about 4:15 a.m.
Wow.
And I was there. I was so tired because I had been picking the night before. And I was, why is the sun coming up at 4 a.m.? What is in my head? And then turned the corner and holy cow, there's a fire NATO on the valley floor. That was crazy.
So did smoke taint?
You know, the There's a lot of science that's coming out of smoke right now, but the farther smoke travels, the less of an effect it has. Yeah. So if you're 20 miles away from a fire, it's nothing like being half a mile away from it. So old smoke, not as dangerous.
I heard that, something like that.
But still, it adds up.
Yeah, sure it does.
Over time.
And we were that same weekend, or maybe, I think we came up for the second fire. Look, I had nothing to do with it, but we came up, I think it was the second fire was going on. And, in Oak Knoll, you know, the grapes were covered with soot, and the fire wasn't really there, but they were.
And you'll get ash.
Too, yeah, lots of ash.
It's terrifying.
And then somebody told me, and not yet to verify, but it makes sense that if the vineyards were near wet vegetation, that sooty type of smoke seemed to cling to the skins. And if it was ambient floating ash,
yeah,
that could be washed off.
Yeah, that's the thing. It may all be smoke, but the compounds in it can be totally different depending on what's burning, what kind of trees. Eucalyptus burning is going to be different than pine burning. But there's so many variables, it's hard to make generalizations.
Have you tasted anything? I would be dying to taste the distillate, because they were selling all those grapes as distillates, right?
Yeah, I haven't had that. I have had smoke taint wine, though. Our big fire in Lake County was in 2018.
Yeah.
It was the Mendocino Complex fire. Some grape varieties are more sensitive than others, so I didn't release Grenache that year. You make a little bit of Grenache.
Really?
It's just, you know, it's a lighter grape. It's really sensitive to smoke. And oddly, some of the heavier red grapes like Petit Verdot and Mourvèdre are incredibly smoke sensitive. So it doesn't have anything to do with skin thickness or anything
compound
like that.
Of the grape and how
it's something
it
about the way, yeah, something about the biology of the grape.
So I've been dying to find somebody that you looked all over the classified ads after the fires and, we got smoke tainted grapes for sale. You can make, you know, mezcal out of it or something. And I thought, I would like to taste that. I mean, they smoke peat for scotch, right? I mean, so you smoke.
Yeah, I know a few people went ahead and distilled, and I haven't had any of it, but I'm curious.
I'd love to taste it. Yeah. We were talking about that a little bit, about the way grapes grow. And it's an agricultural product, and you sometimes there's a lot and sometimes there's less. And during the post-fires, people sought other sources of juice. And we have a family in Dunnigan Hills that we do a lot of business with, and the price went up because, you know, there was no Napa juice, and so people were looking for things to bottle. Did they come to Lake County then at that point?
Yes, definitely.
Looking for whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a couple of years where you can't find grapes on the market. We've also, you know, there are also drought issues.
Right,
so
sure.
The last couple of years, last year our crop was down probably 60%.
Wow.
It was incredibly light in Lake
That's
County
huge.
and Mendocino.
How do you deal with that? I
mean, just suck it up and hope it's better next year.
Whatever it is, it is.
I mean, it's
right?
High quality, but yeah, I mean, to have half your production out there, that's a tough one.
That's tough.
Yeah.
Are you selling then through the wholesale markets in Los Angeles, and I mean in California and the rest of the country, or you have a DTC group, a direct-to-consumer group?
Pretty much just California. Very small. Everything we make is out of our little 10-acre vineyard. So you're only talking about 1,500 cases a year. So it's all very hands-on. I'm out managing canopies and on the tractor. And so
I was gonna wait until later in the conversation to have this conversation, but if you only have 10 acres, not only, but that's a lot to farm. But it's, in the world of wine, it's not a ton.
It feels like a lot when you're pruning.
Yeah, yeah. Right. But you have this amazing variety of Italian varietals, which tasting through them, they're all great representations of what they are. In other words, they're not homogenized. Everything tasted different. It's from the same soil, but different character based on the grape, which is a testimony to winemaking. But what led you into trying Aglianico and Negro Amaro, Nebbiolo? I mean, these are all parts of Italy, Sangiovese.
Yeah. When I was learning about wine, my aha wine moment was Barbaresco. That was the first.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was Marchese di Grezzi, which, you know, is available. It's good stuff.
Sure.
But that was the very first moment where I realized, like, holy cow, this is what wine can be with, you know, it's kind of punching you and it's soothing you and it's floral. That was 2008. I was kind
pretty
of
pretty recently.
Yeah, no, I haven't been. I jumped in wholeheartedly that year. I'd been cooking prior to that for 5 or 6 years professionally, and kitchens are hard. Needed a break, and getting back into sun, getting into the vineyard, but being able to still use my palate, You know, honestly, making wine is a lot like cooking in a kitchen.
Yeah.
It's a lot of sanitation. It's a lot of temperature control. It's a lot of just very fine-tuned sort of listening to the ingredient, as it were, and trying to respond properly and do things that elevate it. So, you know, you're going to sear different proteins at different temperatures and go for different things with them. So having the different varietals, really, it still just feels like an extension of kitchen work to me.
You know, it's interesting that I had a conversation yesterday with a Bulgarian guy. Sounds diminutive. It's like I'm really minimizing it. I had an interesting conversation with a winemaker from Bulgaria. Does that sound better?
Yes. Perfect.
And he was saying he's got Michel Roland's out there, and there's a lot of enologists. I think Paul Hobbs is going out there now. But he asked somebody what the most important aspect of winemaking was, and he said what you just said, which was sanitation. He goes, it's the purity of the winery. That's besides, of course, we understand grape quality is the highest level of importance. Mm. But after that, he was saying how clean your winery is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the fun part. Right. That's for sure. It's not the sexy part. But that's the
cellar rat part.
Yeah. But like, you know, a lot of modern wineries, like everybody else, I'm trying to minimize sulfur use. I'm trying to minimize intervention, move things. You know, these are unfined, unfiltered, and I want them to taste better in 10 years than they do now. So you need to be careful to do that.
It's hard to do when you're minimizing sulfur and doing the things that would normally extend the life of a wine.
But I think like being a chef, you learn how to salt along the way when needed. Maybe you salt to sweat out vegetables, but that's different than finishing salt.
That is the exact analogy that Molly Hill from Sequoia Grove gave me.
Oh, really?
Yes. She says, I'm a chef, and if I need to add a little salt or take a little salt away or whatever we're doing, that's the chef's job. Is the nuances of, so are you, as a chef, were you a minimalist when it came to that? Were you looking for expressing the flavors of the ingredients or?
I think like most people or most chefs in kitchens, you start out, you're progressing really rapidly. In the early 2000s, there was a lot of the modernist cooking. So, you know, you're making foams, you're doing kind of dainty, precious food a little bit and
the
painting.
Atomic cooking.
Yeah, painting on the plate. You know, playing around with sous vide, things like that. But later on, a sous vide is a good example. I like it. I think you can do fantastic things with it. But there's also an immediacy to cooking in a fire, you know, cooking with fire that gets lost with the different method. And for me, I'm fine with things being rustic, but I want them to have a vitality to them.
Sure.
And the more technical the cooking got, although I enjoyed it kind of as a mental puzzle, it started losing that vibrancy and immediacy that I really like. So even today, you know, for me, the wines are the same thing, where you have the acidity, a certain degree of freshness, fruit, all that. But I've always been a texture guy, so I've always been into braises and long cooking, and, you know, texture is super important. So a lot of what I do in the vineyard and with the winemaking is to have, you know, sensations as well. So,
isn't that what it's for? I mean, like food, we'll back up just a little bit. In the 80s, when the Waxmans and the McCartys and those guys were changing the way food was in America, particularly in Los Angeles, you know, it was getting away from the traditional French stuff and trying to be creative as Alice Waters was. Is wine going through that kind of transition as well, where you're doing growing things like Italian varietals in Lake County and trying to express that?
In the last 10 years, the wine industry has changed so much with natural wine and things like that it's hard to tell if it's a pendulum shift or if
it's
a real change. I will say I'm super thankful that people are seeking out new grape varietals and we don't have the homogeneity that we had 15 years ago. I think that's fantastic. I love that. I love seeing things planted in appropriate areas. So if you're in a hot climate, plant some hot climate Portuguese.
Sure.
Southern Italian. Doesn't mean that it's easy to sell, but people are more willing. People are more willing to experiment now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a positive for everybody, especially with California and drought. And, you know, if you're going to plant a vineyard, you want it to be there for 100 years. So you better get the right thing in the right place, if you can.
You know, Michel Roland used that same time frame, 100 years, because that's what it's going to take to figure it out. You know, but particularly if you're changing varietals like this, There's a book called American Cuisine and How It Got That Way by a Yale professor named Paul Friedman.
Yeah.
He's actually a specialist in medieval servitude, but writes about restaurants. And one of them, the other book he wrote was The 10 Restaurants That Changed America.
Oh, yeah.
And
I love that book.
Isn't that a great book? Okay, yeah. So he wrote a book called The Cuisine of America, How It Got That Way. But basically, the theme of it is the homogenization of food in America. We lost our regionality because you could drive from Howard Johnson's to Howard Johnson's and have the same food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the Europeans where they have these protected areas and their butter and their fish and whatever else they're making, and their wine, like yep. Bordeaux and Burgundy. You can only do these sort of things. And that sort of protects the culture. But there's something exciting about what we would call now the world, new world.
Yeah.
You can plant Nebbiolo in Lake County and see how it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And culinarily, too. I mean, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area. You can, these days, go and find just about anything being done really well by small families, you know, pop-ups, small micro-restaurants. I think that's a beautiful thing.
I want to see that. And I have this theory for my own book. I actually talked to Dr. Friedman and said, what do you think of a book charting the homogenization of wine in America? And how we're coming out of that. We're coming out of it with things like you're making, not when you go to the market and look at Cali Red from Snoop Dogg. But, you know, there are these things happening like what you're doing.
But even that could be a positive thing. I mean, we've made wine... wine marketing historically was so kind of rarefied and, you know, and it's a big complex world. If you start looking at grape varieties, Italy has over 700, Portugal has at least 400. That's a lot of stuff to know for a casual wine drinker.
That's true.
We kind of accidentally in trying to sell wine put a lot of barriers that, you know, it's more confusing than beer. To get into
for sure.
So having some of those challenges break down a little bit is great. On the other hand, we also don't want to lose the diversity in doing that. So I think we still have a lot of work to do in the wine industry to sort of help people explore on their own and give them the tools to go do that. And that's something that natural wine has been helpful with too. You know, the sense of it being a little bit more healthy, fewer additives. There was a lot of corporate wine, so the pendulum kind of swung against that. That's how it started.
But think about it for a second. The early winemaking up until probably the 70s, when the Bordelais came out with the copper, you know, dressing.
Yeah.
What else did you have? It was organic. It was natural. They didn't use that other stuff. And
yeah, sort of a post-World War II and post-Prohibition also.
Yeah.
We tend to forget how much Prohibition damaged the wine industry on top of everything. It's like starting all over again.
It was starting over again.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. Actually, the guys that were just in here, that we saw when he walked out, his name is Claudio Salvador. He makes wine in Sardinia, but he was making wine in Ohio.
Oh, right.
And in fact, he still has Ohio company. And
it's amazing.
Wine-making history
out there.
Isn't that crazy? Well, and he said, you know, Ohio was one of the replants of post-Prohibition. I said, I know that Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, they all got replanted after Prohibition because that's where the wine trade was originally.
Yeah. That was the breadbasket of America.
Stuff like that. And it's like, here we are in California. And you're right, there's a lot of wineries that went dormant and some were resurrected. Some are very famous now, like Hess is one of those. But that's an interesting. So this idea that I had, which was a homogenization of the wine world, when I bring that up in many times, and I thought maybe you would, but I like the path you took, and that is a lot, like White Zinfandel in 74, you know, brought people to the table drinking wine that probably weren't drinking it before.
Exactly.
And maybe Martha Stewart Chardonnay, you know, 19 Criminal Chardonnay is doing the same with its, you know, RS level.
Yeah.
But, so that's a good thing, I think.
I think there will always be something like that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want that to be the totality of the market. But, you know, we all find wine. I was around it. My family didn't drink expensive wine. That was a very new thing. I would not have been exposed to it if I hadn't been working at fancier restaurants that had nice wine lists and got to absorb by osmosis a little bit of the culture of it.
What was the motivation to be a chef or get into the food?
You know, that's one of those weird things. I have no idea.
That is a weird thing.
I don't know. A little bit of this does tie into early childhood. I grew up in Sonoma County. And for a period, we were on a 40-acre ranch that had about 20 acres of grapes. French Columbard, Carignan, stuff really like that. You know, the, 60s, 70s.
All the jug wine stuff.
Yeah, there's red, there's white.
Yeah.
You pick them when they're, right. You know, 12.5% alcohol, and you're good to go.
Right.
So, but I always was, I think, a little bit in tune with that sort of agricultural cycle. I'll always, like,
sure.
Even if I'm not buying anything, if there's a farmer's market, I love looking at the vegetables.
Yeah,
I right. always check out the fish counter, even if I'm not hungry. Right. Like, there's something about just being around.
My wife hates when I go to the wine section of the market.
Oh, yeah.
What do you know?
I mean, I know the three distributors, but I'll still yeah, exactly. go through and look at everything. So I'm curious. And I'm a label reader. So
was your
I'm
mom
slow.
A cook?
You know, the family was decent cooking. Yeah. But we didn't eat out much. You know, we had several kids, weren't making a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit challenging. But the couple of times we had decent meals, I remember the first time I had. I'm sure if I had it again today, I'd be like, oh, this is the worst food I've ever had. But it was like a bouillabaisse kind of thing. I had never had those flavors when I was 12 or 13 years old. And it was just amazing.
There's something memorable that, you know, and wine is that same way for
yeah,
me.
I mean, exactly.
You taste something.
I can still taste that Barbaresco. Yeah. I can still taste the first Ribera del Duero that really hit me. You know, that mental Rolodex. It's still
what makes wine so intriguing.
Yeah. No, it engages. I think there are some studies. Like, it engages all the parts of your brain.
Yeah.
It's almost like those primal childhood memories in the way that they form.
We were in Paris with one of the cafes, bistros that looks at the Eiffel Tower. So, you know, it's a tourist thing. I ordered the quiche, and it was the turkey broccoli quiche that my mom used to make. And I told my wife, I said, I haven't smelled this in 50 years. And I just sat there. Mm-hmm. And it was like I went back to like I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
And it was like fascinating to do that. And it happens with wine all the time.
Smell is super primal.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. So it really clicks into like animalistic.
The natural wine thing, we're talking about that. I get a lot of stuff in here. We tasted a couple yesterday. Actually, there was a festival downtown last 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, called the Raw Festival. It's Isabel Legeron from London. No certification to belong to this group. You just have to be mentally intervened.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. I think that's really important in the wine business. I prefer those wines, but some of them are like kombucha, you know, where you're just going, oh my God, you know, look, that's taking it, not necessarily taking it too far, but like, I don't want to, I'm drinking wine for this experience, not to muscle something down because I think I'm being healthy. Right. And I think the feds just got on some labeling issues.
Yeah, a little bit of labeling has come into question about healthy claims. And
right.
Yeah.
So what's your philosophy on that? I mean, you were looking for expression.
Yeah, I would say I come, you know, we're kind of natural adjacent, partially because I'm just a small business. I don't want to be filtering everything. I don't have technology to employ. But as, you know, a former cook, I'm just looking for purity. And I label things, you know, I have labeled Sangiovese, labeled Barbera. I want these things to have a sense of typicity, a sense of place, and then, you know, maybe there's a little bit of personal expression in there too. Maybe there's a little bit of stem inclusion or something like that. So if the way to get there is by being as quote-unquote natural as possible, then that's totally fair game for me. I will say in the vineyard, one of the goals for me is I want older vines and I want them to have a sense of minerality. And there's a lot of evidence that you can't get that with spraying Roundup, whether or not there are health issues.
Wow.
But the soil, the health of the soil, right, and culturing the microbes that produce, you know, the long, intense finishes that you get with older wines, there's more and more evidence that you can't do that with chemical farming.
That's so interesting.
That's a piece of the puzzle too.
Yeah.
We're unusual being small. Most people just grow grapes or buy grapes from other growers. You know, we're actually growing our own. So I've also made mistakes in the vineyard and, you know, the resulting wine, being like, oh, I overthin this, I underthin this. This needs more sun exposure. This needs less. We have a mildew problem here. So I get to respond in real time and learn continually from mistakes. So that's another piece of the puzzle for me, to just have a little more control. It's a little more responsibility too. But, you know, the grapes go a whole 30 yards from the vineyard to the winery.
I think you just explained why it's more expensive to make organic and biodynamic wines. You know, there's the other book that's really interesting you probably read is The Third Plate by Dan Barber at Blue Hill Farms. And he talks about, at some point, even with wheat and all the other crops we've screwed up in America. And the term was like, there's a war going on down there. In other words, underneath that soil, this combat for the nutrition and the microbes that are eating each other, whatever's going on, which ultimately you are what you eats, and the grapes are what they eat too. And if you're spraying Roundup all over, everything is killing everything. I think that jives with what you just said.
Yeah.
That you're losing that minerality, you're losing that expression of the soil.
At the most basic level, think of, you know, similar cattle species and corn finished versus grass fed or something. They taste different.
They do taste different.
You can't deny that. You can't deny a texture difference.
It's funny, my cousin owns a restaurant here in Pasadena. He's done all kinds of tests. It's an Italian restaurant. And he's landed on this three meat mixture. It's like part tri-tip, part whatever for his burger.
For the burger, yeah.
Yeah, and but he'll insist that, at least his purveyors, he could not tell the difference between a grass-fed steak and one that was conventionally fed. And I just took it as face value. Yeah. It seemed hard to believe after reading Dan Barber's book that that was the case, until my neighbor, who brings in New Zealand Wagyu. And it was frozen. Still, it was still frozen steak. Mm-hmm. And that was the most tender, flavorful piece of meat I've ever tasted in my life. And, you know, New Zealand being untouched and all the, you know, the value of it. If it's virgin soil.
Yeah.
It never had been sprayed ever.
These are closed systems.
Yeah. And pretty it's amazing.
Interesting.
So you have these interesting varieties of Aglianico, which is one of my favorites. So we just tasted a Cambria version against it and found this similarity in the structure of the flavors, but different structure of the wine itself, the acidity, et cetera. Because that makes sense, because it's from California versus Campania. But do you think then that there are some things that you just can't make? There's some grapes that you can move around the world. It's just not going to work in different parts of the world.
Like if you try to grape, Pinot producers will definitely talk about, you know, it's too hot in a lot of places to plant Pinot.
Right.
I don't grow Pinot, but I grow Nebbiolo. So if you want to talk about a pain in the ass grape, that is the
grape of Piemonte.
But I've also made Nebbiolo from the Central Valley. Really hot climate, low tannin, very pretty, floral, not a whole lot of finish. Part of it is a question of, like, what's the paradigm you're working with? What are you trying to go for? Should you even be trying to copy? I mean, we can't make Barolo here very well in California. Some areas can get a little bit closer. My climate's actually not that good, but, you know, some of the Santa Barbara Nebbiolo can be Piemontese-ish with, you know, the coastal influence, a little longer ripening season. But is that a good thing?
Yeah, so that's the question.
Do you want to slavishly imitate those kind of things?
Right. That's an important question. And Murray's cell phone's going on. that's okay. In the earlier days of let's say, Willamette Valley.
Yeah. When you start out, you're going to copy.
Yeah, they're copying.
My first menus, I guarantee I stole from the people I worked for.
Oh, yeah. Well.
That's how you learn. And it makes sense. And then those more fine grained differences takes decades.
So you're
to hone in on that.
So you buy, then you agree that, agree or disagree, like, I'm not trying to make Piemonte's Nebbiolo. I'm trying to make Lake County Nebbiolo.
There are aspects that I would like to have be part of my wine that I think are signature of Nebbiolo or should be signature of Nebbiolo. I could be wrong. So when I make Sangiovese, one of the goals for me is after a few years, some of the Chianti Classicos I really love, they get a little bit pine needly, they get a little bit like iodine-y, a little bit minerally savory, bloody. Not everybody loves that. I love that.
Yeah.
So for me, those are a couple key elements that I really want to have in there. And you kind of reverse engineer, how do I hopefully get that in the vineyard? How do I treat the vines?
How does that bode with food, the carrot that you just talked about, the iodine sort of carrot, which I know today you're talking about. How does that bode with food? How do you make that work? That's pretty distinctive.
If I'm making dinner to highlight a very special bottle of wine, wasn't that long ago, I had a pretty amazing coat roti. Had pizza with it.
Really?
Cheap pizza. I mean, cheap pizza is often the easy way to go.
Wish I was hanging around you.
Yeah. It was a friend, so.
Yeah, okay, same.
Thank her so much. Sometimes it's good for the food to take a step back so that the wine can really shine.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, if you've got some mediocre wines in the lineup, you might need to, you know, amp up the pepper, amp up the salt, try to fill in some of where maybe the wine is a little bit deficient. But for me, if it's a nice, you know, a nice Nebbiolo and Barolo, you know, it's going to be risotto. It's going to be a simple pasta. It's going to be something with a few ingredients done really nicely that lets the wine, that act as a springboard for the wine to really open up and present itself.
I'm learning as I cook. I love to cook. My mom's a great cook. Mm-hmm. My daughter's a French-trained boulanger. I think I brought that up before.
Sounds amazing.
And so we cook a lot in the house, and I'm starting to move towards simpler things. And so I always have this question, particularly since you're growing Italian varietals in Lake County, and that is, you know, what came first, the foods or the wine? I have this huge opinion of, you know, wines and foods growing up together in particular parts of the world, for one. I mean, I think it's obviously that kind of makes sense.
Cool. Yeah.
The question is, okay, what came first, the grapes or the wines? But like when I have friends that bring a bottle of Duckhorn Merlot to what would be a pretty indigenous Italian restaurant, it kind of irks them. And I give them crap about it.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, man. I go, you can't be doing this. Let's explore. There's one restaurant in Pasadena, particularly called Union, that their list is curated around their foods. And I'm prepared to pay the bottle price for that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think the affinity for food and wine is nestled in its history and its regional impact?
I think there's something beautiful about that and something educational and something to be preserved, for sure. I mean, there's also the flip side is, you know, dogmatic wine pairings and, you know, Chianti always goes with tomato and it doesn't always. Yeah. And tomatoes aren't just one thing.
Right.
So, you know, it can be more fine-grained and nuanced, and we're so international now that, you know, sometimes I want a Grüner Veltliner and then, something else that's completely bizarre to go with something. We can do that now. But I'm, you know, on one hand, I'm a break everything and start over kind of guy. On the other hand, I like history.
Yeah.
I like knowing the chain of events or thinking that I know something about it and being part of that lineage. So,
you know, it's a seasonal aspect,
hard
too.
To say. Yeah. Right? Oh, totally.
So important.
Well, if you look at really fine grain, do you ever follow the biodynamic wine?
Like somebody brought me the chart the other day because they were looking at the Jesuit Paris date.
For me, and I know not everybody experiences it the same, it is terrifyingly accurate.
Really?
I can taste a wine and tell when we're on a root day.
Really?
And then my wine, for me, and again, I don't know if it's the wine, I don't know if it's the stars, I don't know if it's just my brain or my tongue, it'll taste radically different 18 hours later when it goes to a fruit day.
I would totally buy
it's
that.
Terrifying.
I would totally buy that.
I'm sure you've experienced it and then just...
Not understood.
And just somebody showed me the app, and every time I was working in a wine shop, this is tasting like a root day. It's like, holy cow.
I can see that.
Totally accurate. Like, and I hadn't 90% really thought of the time.
I really thought about it until this guy literally brought in last Tuesday when I taste wines, the chart from 1976, May 24th, when they did the Judgment of Paris. Uh-huh. And he was just checking to see if that was a fruit day or not.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, it was so on the cusp, like whether or not it was like, what time was it tasting?
Yeah, no, it's, yeah.
I thought that was really
interesting. I don't know how it works, but there's something creepy about it.
Well, you know, there's the book. You can't see it there. This is Rudolf Steiner's book right there. Piero Cenza from Chateau Bacra, not Chateau, Chakra Barda. Barda, I can't remember the name. He's a Patagonian Pinot Noir maker.
Huh?
And you talk about radically different wines from vintage to vintage.
Mm.
There is no attempt to bring out the bottle of what they brought up the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, the armadillos are returning. I'm like, what? Who says that in the wine world, right? And so, but he was saying, if the Earth, if the moon's gravitational pull can shift tides 7/10 of the Earth into different heights, and wine, grapes, your body, the Earth is 70% water or 90% water. What can it do? What's it doing? It's doing a lot. Now, yeah. That's a pretty profound thing to say.
I hadn't thought about it like that. That's
pretty
intense.
Profound comment.
Wow.
There were a lot of, when I started this industry in 1988, my dad started the 60s actually, Paso was kind of known for its Italian varietals. There was Nebbiolo from the Martin Brothers. There was San Luisi.
It's Caperone.
Gotten away from that.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, I mean, Cabernet, it's hard to escape the gravity of Cabernet these right. days. If you're growing grapes and, you know, that's where the market is, it doesn't make sense to plant Nebbiolo.
You got to pay. I mean, you got to pay the bills.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But I, just using Paso as an example, there are really cool AVAs, too. There are cooler climate, more coastal. You can do a lot in Paso. So kind of like Lodi. Sure, you can think of it as one thing, but actually it's a huge area with different microclimates, different soil types, all these different things you can do. So I think part of it's just figuring out what does well for you and, you know, hopefully pays the bills at the same time.
You know, it's funny you said that, cause not funny, but it's right on. I two wines came through here recently that were a complete departure from their predecessor. One of them would be the Dow wines. The Dow is a sort of Austin Hope, Camus, you know, oxygenated huge grapes, but they also make this Patrimony, which is from the hills. I forgot the appellation, but a complete departure from those style.
I've heard about it, but I haven't had it.
Yeah, it's not inexpensive.
Well,
but clearly not trying to be that.
Okay.
The real, you know, that mainstream Cabernet you get from Paso. The other area is the real southern part of Paso. I forgot the AVA now. It's a wine called Agent Peaks. Again, you get a much more Bordeaux-esque wine, something that's not part of the central part of the thing. I guess there's 11 AVAs in Paso or something like that.
Yeah, it's big, 11 or 12.
So in Lake County, I'm looking at your map that you brought, and here we are. We're due north of Napa. We don't have the, it doesn't seem like we have the influence of the marine layer.
Yeah, we're pretty far away from the ocean, probably a good 40 or 50 miles. And then we have the Mayacamas mountain range also filtering out.
And kind of protecting that.
Yeah. So we don't get a whole lot of coastal influence. There are a couple channels in the north and to the south where you get more rainfall, sometimes double of where we are.
Really?
But you don't see fog in Lake County. It's much more, you know, blue sky, warm every day from May until November.
Clear Lake is a natural lake?
Yes. Yeah. It's actually, it sits on a rock basin. It's pretty shallow, and it's sort of draining from one end and filling another end.
Is there a recreation center?
You can, yeah. There's a lot of boat, a lot of hiking. You can hike up to the Mount Conocti volcano to the peak now, which is super cool.
Oh, yeah.
See the whole county really makes sense.
I read, you know, when I saw Conocti in your bio, I was reading something, and I go, I haven't seen, there used to be a winery called Conocti.
Yeah.
I've featured their wines a few times, and I haven't heard of them for years, unless they're not around anymore.
There's some custom crush, but I think there were actually back in the 70s or 80s, possibly some Napa Valley vintners that were labeling under the Mount Conocti.
Yeah, no, it was actually a Conocti vineyard. I have to look it up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's why I brought it up. You have, looks like Lake County as an entire AVA, but then
yeah, that's sort of the general grape growing area, just encompassing everything. But then we have several smaller sub AVAs.
Like six.
Yeah, that's right.
So would you say, when I'm talking about AVAs in Lake County, like, would I tell the difference between the Red Hills, which is a, you know, they make, that makes huge wines, and a High Valley? I mean, what am I seeing there?
Possibly. Well, I'll contrast, High Valley is a little bit similar, just it's, you know, it's a lot of mountain peaks, a good amount of wind, rocky soils.
Mm-hmm.
But like an area like Livermore, you can, because of the wind, that actually starts affecting what you can grow and protects the grapevines. Around the lake is Big Valley, and that's where a lot of the Sauvignon Blanc that you see from Lake County comes from.
Big Valley, I see
and also a lot of Merlot. There's in a lot of stuff planted down there. Red Hills versus that, say you have
Cabernet. Red Hills versus Anthelis. I mean, is it that? I mean, AVAs are hard to get. They take a lot of work.
Yeah, you got to want it.
But you got to explain that to the feds that they're different than this neighbor.
Yeah. No, Red Hills is unique. I think it starts at about 1,800 foot elevation and right now has vineyards up to 32 or 3,300.
Well, that's pretty high.
That's pretty high.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have a lot of these really volcanic, Obsidian Ridge, one of the famous local wineries. Their vineyard looks like nothing but big obsidian chunks.
Really?
It's incredible. Yeah, those hills are just, they have to rip them so hard just to be able to plant vines because the soil is so unforgiving. But that also means you're going to get a lot of minerality and a lot of long finish 10, 15 years down the road. Yeah. So you're planting long term. Gets hot in the summer, but you have that wind because you're up in the mountains. That can actually help grapevines go to sleep a little bit when it's the hottest and extend their ripening time.
Is it becoming a destination for wine?
A little bit. You can travel around the lake and go to different tasting rooms. Right. It's 2 hours from San Francisco. So it's a little bit of a ways.
Is Sacramento closer?
Same. It's like equidistant from every place where people live.
I need to go to Sacramento to talk to Daryl Cordy, so I was just I'll go do that and then come up there.
Yeah, it's the same distance. But it's a beautiful area. It's kind of like, I compare it usually to the Sierra foothills. It's very rocky. It's a lot of sparse vegetation, but it's its own, you want to get on your horse and grab your gun and go ride around and look for gold kind of thing.
Yeah, that's cool.
It has that aspect to it.
But and that's in Guanac, the Guanac AVA, which looks like it's south of there.
And that goes back for a while, just is on that the backside of Napa. Yeah.
The Guanac winery?
Guanac, Langtree.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
I didn't realize that was Lake County.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of that Pope Valley area. The county cuts it off about halfway. So
I had what's his name once. He was a soils engineer or something. What was his name? I did a wine dinner for Guanac.
Have you been out there?
No, I've never been up that far.
It's a really interesting area.
Let's check it out.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Again, rocky. It's rugged.
So there are hotels. I mean, I don't want to sound ignorant, but I mean,
there are a couple
places to hang
out. There aren't a whole lot.
Not really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit limited. There's a really cool hotel up on the north side of the lake. That's I think it's an 1880s redone thing. And there's a restaurant there too.
But coming over, let's say I'm in Yountville. I'm going to run up to Lake County by an hour's
drive. You can stop in Middletown, and they have a lot of mud baths, geothermal type thing.
I'm not doing
not
that.
Your thing.
You want to know why? Because we were in Calistoga once, and we asked the guy when he changes the mud.
He changes the mud
every 30 days. I'm like, that's disgusting. And when was the last time? 29 days ago. Not doing that. So what are your plans? What's next? What are you experimenting with right now? And how big do you want to get? And what are you trying to explain
good
to people?
Question. Haven't really planted anything in the last few years. Sagrantino was the last thing I planted in 2014.
I read that. Sagrantino.
Yeah. Yeah, it actually, crazy. It does, it can take the heat.
Really?
And it's, that one's really interesting because each additional year of vine age, the wine is getting more and more depth to it. Like it's changing before your eyes kind of thing. The first couple of years were just very candied red fruit. And now we're getting all that roasted herb earthiness and the weird floral tones that Sagrantino can have.
That sounds
exciting.
Huge grape and
it's a lot of tannin and a lot of alcohol.
I haven't brought this name up for a while, except the group that was in here earlier from Sardinia. I was telling about Valentino Valentini, who was the mayor of Montefalco, who's been in here a couple of times. He's a good friend, and he makes wonderful Sagrantino under the Bocali brand. But the reason I brought it up was once a year during Christmas time, I'm on a show. I'm not going to tell you the name of the host because then it'll be embarrassing. But he's on one of the big networks. And I'm a call-in guest that we use the studio. Mm-hmm. And we talk about wine going into the holidays. And he's in Texas. And Lubbock's got a pretty good trade, right?
Yeah.
And we happened to be on our way to Fredericksville when we were there last. And we stopped at something house. I forgot the name of the winery. And I, it was close. So he's talking about the Sargento. This is like live TV. He goes, have you had the Sargento? And what's the call? And what do you do? Correct the guy? You know, on his show?
Yeah.
You just let it go.
That's a tough one.
You just let it go.
You mean the mediocre cheese?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But Sagrotino is a rough animal, and I'm impressed that you're trying that, because I don't, I mean, how much Sagrotino could be grown in California?
There might be 70 acres now.
Yeah, totally.
There are a few vineyard blocks. I think there are a couple in Paso now, but Dry Creek Valley has at least four that I know of. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, yeah. And Sierra Foothills has some as well.
Do you think that, is that the definition of the new world? You know, being able to do that? You know, being able to say, grow whatever you want? And, you know, I mean, I understand
this. Probably. I mean, hopefully New World entails some sense of judgment, too.
Yeah, right. It seems to be two definitions.
It's California. You can do whatever. We don't have the baggage of history.
Right.
That can be good.
Right.
It can be a little bit bad. But
it could be stifling the other way around.
It could be a good thing, though.
Yeah.
We're still young in this. I mean, this is for our culture.
Right.
But we're still children figuring this out.
That's what's fascinating about the whole thing, right? It goes back.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I had a winemaker in here, fascinating woman, brilliant winemaking person, and she was talking about an organization she started called the Aremi Global Foundation. It was this whole promotion of wine and culture and protecting it. So big thing.
Neat.
But Aremi is the name of a grape from Armenia.
Mm-hmm.
And up until now, the Armenian trade, the Armenian winemaking technology was horrible. I went there in 2006, you couldn't drink anything. And now it's much better. There's a lot coming in. Yeah. It's too much coming in right now. But for the first time on Tuesday, I tasted an Aremi Noir, it's called, that had, in my opinion, world-class structure, world-class expression of where it's from, and really a quality wine. And I thought that was really fascinating. But Aremi, she said, we called this organization Aremi because they found a winery in Armenia that's 6,000 years old.
Yeah.
So we're like, what, 100 years? Not even.
Yeah, 150. I mean, Gold Rush.
Yeah, right. That's pretty much it. In fact, there's a book.
Well, I shouldn't say that. Obviously, the Spanish missions, but.
I'll finish with this thought because we're already almost on 50 minutes here.
But,
there's a book, the cookbook for Omar Khayyam's, which was a restaurant in San Francisco for years and was a very famous place.
I haven't seen that.
Has this preamble, they're closed now, but they had this preamble of what was going on during the Gold Rush when it came to food and wine. You know, those guys are drinking French Bordeaux?
Yeah.
They're making so much money that they're buying wine off the boat, you know?
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Can you imagine that?
You've been up in the hills working.
Yeah, right, they're drinking.
You got your gold.
Lafitte and Margaux, anyway.
That's the dream.
Pietro, a fascinating conversation. I hope we can do it again. And I'd love to visit you up there. I want to taste some of those other things you're making. But clearly the effort here of experimenting with grapes and expressing Lake County through unusual varietals is really successful.
Thank you.
At least from a
really appreciate
palate
that.
Standpoint.
And quick plug, our tasting room is in Oakland. So if you ever go to San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah, we fly into Oakland.
Oh, yeah.
I always fly into Oakland.
Welcome to come down.
So
let me know.
It downtown or where is that?
Right by the Berkeley border in Temescal area of Oakland.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, happy definitely to swing you. In there.
That'd be fantastic.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And good luck the rest of the day. I don't know what you got on your schedule, but fascinating conversation and wines.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you for listening to Wine Talks with Paul Callum Carrion. Don't forget to subscribe because there's more great interviews on their way. And of course, all these podcasts are sponsored by the original Wine of the Month Club, 48 years in business. Don't forget to visit our website, wineofthemonthclub.com. Folks, have a great time out there in the wine world. Cheers.